I don't think by that stage anybody had any doubt but that the game was up. The chairman himself was never reconciled to resigning.
Welcome to Boardroom Confidential, a podcast by Sherpany where business leaders tell the stories they usually only share with their peers. Each episode, we have three items on the agenda: pressure, lessons, and boardroom dynamics. I'm Emily Sheffield, journalist, broadcaster, and former newspaper editor. I've had the honour of joining a number of boards and currently sit on the board of the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London. And I'm looking forward to sitting down with senior leaders to talk about what really goes on behind boardroom doors when the pressure's on and the stakes are high. Joining me this week is Sir John Tusa. John has been involved in arts management and leadership for more than 30 years. After 6 years as managing director of the BBC World Service, he ran the Barbican Centre for 12 years up until 2007. He was executive chairman of the CLAW Leadership Programme until 2014 and has sat on some of the major British arts boards, including the British Museum, the English National Opera and Wigmore Hall. John served as chairman of the board at the University Arts London for 6 years and co-chaired the European Youth Orchestra. His book, On Board, The Insider's Guide to Surviving Life in the Boardroom, is regarded as a standard text for the sector. Welcome to the podcast, Sir John.
Thank you, Emily. Very nice to be with you.
Very nice to have you here. Agenda item number one is pressure. Two of the boards I sat on had serious financial pressures at varying times. And in both cases, it was the boardroom really pulling together, working collegiately, that got us through the worst of times. So, John, I am really interested to hear your experiences. Can we start with the English National Opera? This was a period of great turmoil, I believe, both financial and with high executive turnover. Can you set the scene for the listener, perhaps, and then describe initially how you reacted before going on to describe how the board responded?
Yes, I'm happy to do so. I joined the board of English National Opera in 1994, and at that stage it had a big reputation as being an opera company that produced very original productions of a wide range of repertoire, and it was sold very effectively. The management and creative team were sold as the powerhouse, and everybody thought that English National Opera could do no harm. Behind all this, and when the director then left, because he was just standing down, a new director came in, he took one look at the books and said, the financial situation is really very poor, the opera companies, the opera performances aren't doing as well as they should, and he then had to put up with a whole series of crises between the opera, the board, and the Arts Council. And this lasted for about 4 or 5 years. And there were constant debates, not so much within the board. There were some of those, I'll say a bit about that, but with the Arts Council. And the trouble was that just when we thought, we the board, thought that we had an agreement with the Arts Council, as the chairman of English National Opera later said, I shook hands with the Arts Council on future funding on three occasions, and the Arts Council never came through with the money. The board's response, and we backed the director, but after one director had been trying to make ends meet for 4 years, we agreed that he had to go. He agreed too that that was a tragedy. We then appointed another director who, if anything, was, so to say, even more calmed. He only lasted about a couple of years, and he would not take the advice of the board. We then appointed somebody completely unsuitable because, you know, we were running out of candidates. And by the time we'd got rid of, and it was getting rid of, the third director, I said to the chairman, any board can get rid of one chief executive. Some boards can get rid of two. No board can get rid of three, and we have to resign, which we did. And ever since then, English National Opera, I'm sad to say, has been in difficulties. So the board didn't solve that one, and it wasn't for lack of trying. It was just a very difficult situation.
And looking back now, what leadership were you getting from the chairman at the time? What do you think was working and what wasn't working?
The chairman, Uncle John Baker, gave very strong leadership, but he said certainly afterwards, he said that he didn't feel that he was ever given the full picture of what was going on by the then chief executive, who was, I liked him personally, that's not the point. The chief executive was not candid. And that's, after all, as you know, lesson number one. If the chair and the chief executive do not get on, if they're not absolutely close and confidential, then you are in real difficulty. Eno was in real difficulty, and I'm afraid we never got out of it.
What have you learned in the intervening years? What would you have done differently as a board member yourself?
I think I would have explored very much more what the relationship was between the chairman and the general director, both of whom I knew and liked, but clearly that never worked. And I think, as the chairman said, he needed to have, and the board needed to have, absolutely honest numbers about what was happening at English National Opera. He never felt they were there. The board was constantly taken by surprise. So was the Arts Council, to be fair to them. And we never got out of that tussle. And that shows that's what happens if the board executive relationship doesn't work. In the end, the organisation, the institution, pays the cost, and it's a big one.
And then also I wanted to pick up on what you said about persuading the board that they all had to stand down. Take us through some of the sort of drama of that moment. Did you do it in one of your sort of four big board meetings a year? And how did different people react? You know, how did you approach that?
No, I did it over a lunch. I had lunch with the chairman, and who I knew well and liked. And it was just in the course of the lunch, I said, look, Martin, we can't go on like this. You know that. And I said, but I've already said to you. I said, we have now got to go. I forget whether I said that I'd be the first to go. I don't think by that stage anybody had any doubt but that the game was up. The chairman himself was never reconciled to resigning.
I think, from my experience, physical board meetings and relationships with fellow board members are incredibly important. And especially during those high pressure moments, and being having those board meetings when you are all, or most of you are in the room four times a year for a couple of hours. In those very high pressure moments for you, how did that physical interaction help, and how important do you think that sort of knowing the rest of your board and being in a room and talking out these problems is in those high pressure moments?
It's extremely important, because that's the way that you learn how other people are reacting. You know after a while how their judgments are likely to go. You know when they make a particular intervention that is for a very good reason, and either sometimes you'll discount it, but other times you'll say, well, if X is saying so, then I'd better take it very seriously. And it is just pleasant. I sat at the British Museum. Somehow, I found myself often sitting next door to Tom Phillips, the artist. And Tom concentrated at board meetings by doing incredibly elaborate, almost mathematical-style doodles on the board papers. They were works of art, so there'd be the board paper, and then Tom would work at it. It wasn't that I could guess what Tom would say, but I knew that whatever our reaction was, I felt so close to him, I knew that it would, that I could rely on that reaction. My only regret was that I never said to him at the end of the meeting, Tom, have you got one of those doodles by any chance which you're prepared to slip over to me? I didn't say it, probably rightly, but I'm sorry. Because it is a work of art.
Now we're going to move on to agenda item number two. What are some of the biggest boardroom lessons you've learned? The construction of a board, for example. What's your advice here to a chairman?
There were two people who were put on the board at English National Opera who really didn't like the organisation. I didn't see the point of that, and it was so obvious that it really didn't help. Somebody had said, you've got to put these tough people on, and they'll get E&O to take some serious decisions. That didn't work. In the BBC, where I was on the board of management, but I observed what happened on the board of governors, there were, I sometimes thought, more members of the BBC board of governors, the supervisory board, who disliked the BBC than people who liked the BBC, still less liked the way it was going. That was actively unpleasant, because you looked at these people sitting there supervising what you were doing, and you thought, you know, they really, A, I don't think they understand, and B, they do not like what we are doing. So what on earth are you doing here? But don't he tell you about the politics surrounding the appointment of the BBC Board of Governors, but as a case study of what happens when you have a board which actively dislikes the board of management. That's what happens. So put people on the board who sympathise with what the organisation is for, but are ready and are ready to be critical of it in order to make it as good as they can. And then you need a bit of humour. By the way, don't appoint big egos. Don't appoint people who think that they are, A, cleverer than the board or cleverer than the board of management. My American governance guru said, governance is governance and management is management. And if you're in governance, you don't tell the management what to do. There may be a time when you have to sack the chair, but that's not because you've been trying to tell them what to do. So temperament, cohesion, not that everybody is the same. Absolutely not. You know, one of the people that I had on the University of the Arts London board was Grayson Perry, the transvestite ceramicist. That's his own description, by the way. And I said to Grayson, I want you on the UAL board. It was academic, so he thought, yes, why not? Then he said, you know, what do you want me to do? I said, I want your common sense. You know, there's no category around you. But in a way, the students at UAL would say, hey, I like a board which is running the university, and they've got somebody like Grayson Perry on it. But I wanted him for his common sense and his good humour, as well, or a good sense of humour. And Grayson defined his purpose. He said, well, I wasn't sure what I could do, but I thought maybe I'm like a seagull hovering over the deck of the Titanic, and maybe something I drop will fall into the captain's eye and make him pay attention.
Great description.
That's all he did. But he was just very, very, very commonsensical. And he then found that as he made, I'll call them commonsensical observations, when people said, oh, well, on this subject, as Grayson said, such and such, and that was very reinforcing. And that also meant that people were listening and they respected and so on and so forth. But harmony and the skills are in the background. But anybody who thinks they are bigger than either the board or the organisation, you do not want to touch them.
I was recently interviewed for another arts board position, and I felt they focused very much in the interview on the committee I would be on, which was fundraising. But I felt that being on a board is so much more than just managing the committee you are on. But committees are a hugely important aspect around all boards. And sometimes these can be quite badly managed and organised, and therefore not, you know, they don't bring much to it. But in my experience, well done, they can be hugely beneficial. What's your view on this, John? And was there a sort of committee you sat on that you felt you brought a lot of benefit to the board? And
what I can say is that at the University of the Arts, which was a large organisation, and the committees mattered, so to say, they didn't need to matter, but they did. And I'll give you two examples. The audit committee, you know, usually people say, oh, the audit committee, etc., etc. Well, we did have a very good city accountant who was the chair of it, and I sat on the committee as well. And I will always remember the occasion we were looking at the university's risk analysis. And everybody, the university itself and all the component colleges, had been asked for their assessment of risk. And they produced a document of about 10, 12 pages with, I think, 150 risks. And David Linsall, the accountant, just looked at it and said, what is this supposed to be? And they said, well, Bill Chair, this is a risk analysis. He said, nobody can work to this. This is nonsense. It's an industry. It's an activity. He said, I want at most 8 or 9 risks. That's all, because that's the reality. All the rest is just made up. And they went away. And he also said, and for good measure, if we're having a risk register, why don't we have an opportunities register as well? And those are two things that everybody went away and said, yes. And in a way, it's also a bit like objectives, which come up in other committees. Objectives become an industry. Everybody has to have objectives. The chair of the British Museum, Niall Fitzgerald, who ran Unilever, and he was at a meeting with other big institutional chairs at the Department for Culture, and they were discussing objectives. And Niall said, well, I've been chair of Unilever for 6 to 7 years, and I find that if I get most people to follow 6 of my 9 objectives, I think we're doing pretty well. So that was, you know, that's how you run Unilever. Let's say 8 objectives, and if people are following 6, you're doing well. At the interval, the coffee interval of this meeting, a civil servant came up looking a bit pale and said, I think you'd like to know that just before this meeting started, the department had its own meeting with objectives, and we agreed to 54. And these things just become a nonsense. So I think it's the job of the committees, management committee, the audit committee, the budget committee, and things like that, to look at the components that are needed to run an organization and to say we need something more effective, simpler, and practical. Because if you say people have a risk register, they've got to dream up risks, whether they exist or not.
I liked your observation before, which is about you shouldn't just have risk agendas. You need opportunity agendas.
Yes. Yes, I think that will be a great policy. I don't know if anybody who does, or maybe they do them in different ways. One of the most constructive things we did at the BBC World Service, incidentally, was when we were looking for our second, third round of funding while I was there, we set up an entire organisation to say, what do we, you, the people in the BBC World Service, want the BBC World Service to be from the year 2000, 2010? That was actually saying, create opportunities, define opportunities, pitch your ideas over there. That worked terribly well. It was wonderful for the organization. I forget now how much it was done. Some of it was done, but actually the process of saying, give me your ideas, is absolutely crucial. And it's fun. I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, what are we doing? What are we doing? It's supposed to be having fun and producing good institutions for the benefit of people who use them.
Now we're going to move on to agenda item number 3, which is boardroom dynamics. You've spoken, and we've spoken a little bit already, about having a properly constructed board. But I think how people behave in the boardroom is crucial, isn't it?
What I am aware of, and I think this certainly plays into the question of boardroom behaviour, 2 of the best meetings that the British Museum Board ever had. One was about the possibility of sending back the Parthenon sculptures to Greece. And, you know, that was put on the table in an open way. Is this something the board should do? Leave aside the question as to whether it is legal or possible, etc.
And this debate is still going on at the British Museum, as we know.
For very good reasons. And there was a crucial intervention from a wonderful board member called Edmi Leventis, a Greek Cypriot. And she just said, look, whatever you, the board, may be inclined to decide, with all the experience that I have, let me assure you, if once the Parthenon sculptures went back to Greece, no matter what the terms of the agreement might be, once they're on Greek soil, they would never be able to return, because any government which tried to return them would fall. Now, that was, as you can imagine, I think it's still true, by the way.
It's still true. Like, it was reported recently that even the Greek government said that. So,
but that was in the middle of an absolutely open discussion. We then had a wonderful discussion about a different kind of restitution, the restitution of human remains, which some of which have become either art objects or quasi-art objects or deemed to be art objects. There was an absolutely fantastic discussion where everybody took part, and that was the lawyer's contribution was very, very important. That sort of thing was the board at its best. The whole debate was took place in a intellectually and in free way and in a human way. Now, some of the arguments at English National Opera were much more heated. They never became, not to the point of being taken outside and I'll see you on the corridor sort of thing.
But strong opinions were given. What happens in I mean, I haven't had this experience, actually. I've sat on boards where there's been a very strong chairman, or even, if there isn't a chairman, we're in an interim period at the moment. The leadership has come quite naturally. What happens, though, when you've got two quite strong characters who both think they're leader?
You mean chairman and chief executive?
Yeah. Well, if the leadership doesn't feel clear, even if it's stated.
Ah, yes. Well, if there's any confusion about roles at the top, that is a disaster. When I was chair of the court of the University of the Arts London, and we appointed Nigel Carrington, a former lawyer, but he's still a lawyer, as vice-chancellor, and incidentally, he was interviewed six times before, in six stages before he got the job. He always said that was incredibly important to him because he saw that the organisation, the university, was serious about it. So take your time when you appoint, parenthesis. Nigel and I, when he's appointed, I said, listen, there are two things about our relationship. Number one, no surprises. And number two, you will always hear it from me first. And I expect the same. You will never find somebody saying, well, actually, Tusa thinks this as the chair. I said, never, never, never. And we worked together for 7 years, and that was never violated. It was wonderful. And at the Wigmore Hall, I would sit on the right-hand side of the hall, more or less adjacent across the aisle to the director. And that meant that as we were sitting down for a concert or, having a chat in the interval, he and I, and this occurs with the present director as well, could exchange gossip, a lot of gossip, sometimes about musicians, sometimes about politics, sometimes about people. It was that close. And when you're that close, it's as close as a relative. But unless you like and trust the person, you can't possibly do it. But it's also true, as my American guru, Ken Dayton, said, the relationship is between the chair and the chief executive is that you are the best and closest of partners until I, the chair, have to sack you. So you have to deal with that the role of the chair is to make sure that there's the right person leading it. But if there's none of that, first of all, if there's none of that trust and none of that clarity, it's an absolute nightmare.
I've so enjoyed your insights, and I'm sure our audience have, but we always finish with one final question. If you could go back to your first board meeting, what would you tell yourself?
Number one, you may have had an induction which tells you how to behave on a board. Pay no attention to it. It will have no effect on what really happens on a board. It's all theory. Number two, it's hard work, but it pays off. Remember that. Number three, watch the chair and the CEO. If you spot that from the very beginning that there's something strange about how they get on or don't get on, that is a danger sign. And accept, the more time you give it, the better it'll be.
So John Tusa, thank you so much for sharing your boardroom stories with us and giving us your time and commitment. You've been listening to Boardroom Confidential, a podcast by Sherpany. Find out more at sherpany.com. And make sure you subscribe to the Boardroom Confidential podcast to hear more business leaders tell the stories they usually only share with their peers.